Hello, this is Beth Ludwig from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall share with you information from the Ladies Home Journal, February 2011 edition. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The Pioneer Woman Tells All. In this exclusive excerpt from her new book, Ree Drummond describes the great romance of her life and how she went from city girl to country wife. Better known as the Pioneer Woman, Ree Drummond has captured the imagination of millions of readers through her award-winning blog, thepioneerwoman.com. Devoted readers log on daily to check out her latest photos, recipes, and musings about life on the Oklahoma prairie with her hunky cowboy husband, whom she calls Marlboro Man, and their four children. Drummond's unlikely transformation from Starbucks-loving urbanite to rural wife and mother began in the mid-1990s, when she broke off a long-term relationship and moved from Los Angeles, where she'd gone back to college, back to her Oklahoma hometown. It was to be a pit stop on the road to an exciting new life in Chicago. Then, unexpectedly, she met the man who would turn her world upside down. It had been 4 months since I had locked eyes with the Marlboro Man in a bar over Christmas, since he made my knees turn to overcooked noodles, and since he failed to call the next day. Throughout that time, whenever I allowed myself to remember his steely blue gaze, his prematurely gray hair, his quiet manner that was so drastically unlike all the silly city boys I had known, a salty wave of disappointment would wash over me. But it didn't matter, I told myself. I was moving to Chicago in a few weeks. I had zero business getting attached to anyone around here, least of all some Wrangler-wearing cowboy. So when the phone rang one Saturday afternoon in April, I assumed it was a friend I had seen the previous night. "Ree," said a deep voice, "we met at the J Bar last Christmas." 26 hours later, he was on my parents' doorstep, his starched blue denim shirt illuminating his equally blue eyes. "Hello," I said, smiling. I was wearing sleek blue-black pants, a violet sweater, and spiked-heeled boots. Fashion-wise, we were hilariously mismatched. We walked through dinner, and we talked through dinner, about my upbringing on the grounds of a country club, about his childhood on his family's cattle ranch, about my passion for ballet, about his for football, about my brother Mike, who's developmentally disabled, about his brother Todd, who died as a teenager. By the end of the evening, I had no idea what he had eaten or said. All I knew was that I was riding in an F-250 Ford diesel pickup with a cowboy, and there was nowhere else on earth I'd rather be. After 2 weeks, Ree was madly in love and decided to stay in Oklahoma. Following a courtship involving quiet dinner, starlit evenings on his porch, and more than a few awkward encounters with ranch animals, Ree enthusiastically accepted Marlboro Man's marriage proposal. Word of our engagement spread throughout my hometown of 35,000. The fact that I would now be hanging up my black pumps to move to a ranch in the middle of nowhere, Marlboro Man lived 20 miles from the nearest town, raised a few eyebrows. I could almost hear the whispers through the grapevine. "I just can't picture re-riding a horse. She's the last person I would ever imagine in the country. Seriously, re-marrying a cattle rancher?" But Marlboro Man was no country bumpkin. He was poised, gentlemanly, intelligent. And oddly, over time, I found that the prairie suited me. We loved taking drives together, and Marlboro Man showed me everything, pointing out pastures and signs and lakes, and giving me the story behind them. The land made sense to him. He saw it not as one wide-open, never-ending space, but as a neatly organized parcels with its own purpose and history. For him, it pulsated with the heartbeats of all who lived before. I began to realize just how complementary our differences were. Where I'd always been quick to fill a conversational void, I now let the silence between us work its magic. Where I used to end dinner by calling friends to meet for a drink, now I sit on Marlboro Man's porch and listen to the coyotes howl. He offered me a slower pace and permission to be comfortable in the absence of exciting plans. I, in turn, gave him a little something. I was likely the first girl he had dated who didn't know how to saddle a horse. On our wedding day, Ree had a panic-induced sweat attack just moments before she walked down the aisle. Once my bridesmaids had sopped up the last of my perspiration with an entire box of tissues, I heard the organ playing Bach. "Time to go," the altar guild worker announced. I darted into the bathroom to check myself one last time. I was sweaty and flushed, which I would hope would translate to healthy and glowing. I gave my bangs a quick finger comb and tried to take a deep breath as my bridesmaids began to march down the aisle. Clouds carried me forward. I knew there were others in the church, but I only saw my groom. My heart pounded in my chest as we kneeled. We repeated our vows, and Father Johnson administered the blessing, ending with, "I now pronounce you husband and wife." I hadn't considered the kiss. I supposed I assumed it would be restrained, appropriate, the way a wedding kiss should be, real kisses for when you are alone, not in front of everyone. But Marlboro Man had missed that memo outlining the rules for kissing in public. He wrapped his arms around me and kissed me like he meant it, right there in front of our families, Father Johnson, our wedding party, and some 600 guests. He kissed me exactly the way he kissed me the night of our first date. Unexpected news from the home forced the couple to cut short their honeymoon. Then, just 5 weeks after the wedding, a visit to the family doctor revealed, to Ree's surprise, that she was pregnant. The nausea lingered for weeks as I acclimated myself to my strange new life. Since we lived 20 miles from the nearest grocery store, I had to keep remembering to buy more than 12 hours worth of groceries at a time. I couldn't just run next door to the neighbor's house when I ran out of eggs. There were no neighbors. And there was no such thing as pizza delivery or Chinese food or sushi. Marlboro Man had to spend Thanksgiving weekend weaning the calves that had been born the previous spring. Since I was finally getting better, I no longer had a get-out-of-jail card to sleep till 9. He woke me up Saturday morning by poking my ribs. "Come on," he said. "Come wean cows with me." I opened my eyes. My husband was fully clothed in Wranglers and a starched plaid shirt. He was rubbing my belly, a favorite new habit of his. "I can't," I said. "I'm pregnant." "Yep, you are," he said. I wriggled and squealed and finally relented, getting dressed and heading out the door with my strapping cowboy. We drove a couple of miles to a pasture and met up with the rest of the crew. I rode in the feed truck with an older cowboy while the others followed the herd on horseback. All the while, I watched Marlboro Man out the window. He darted and weaved in the herd, shifting his body weight and posture to nonverbally communicate his wishes to his loyal horse. I breathed in slowly, feeling a sense of pride. There was something magical about seeing the man I was crazy in love with riding his horse across the tall grass prairie. It was more than the physical appeal of his chaps cloaked body in the saddle. It was seeing him do what he loved and what he was good at doing. When Ree arrived at the hospital to give birth, she and Marlboro Man were both certain that their firstborn would be a son. It's an indescribable feeling, the throes of hard labor, that mind-numbing total body cramp whose origins you can't even begin to wrap your head around. Wanting to be strong in front of Marlboro Man, I gripped the bedsheet and clenched my teeth. Finally, I gave in and pushed the nurse button, whispering, "I can't do this anymore." My salvation arrived in the form of an 8-inch needle. When the medicine hit, I nearly wept with relief. I was so blissfully pain-free that I fell sound asleep. When I woke up, the nurse was telling me it was push time. After a few tense moments that involved my repeatedly reminding Marlboro Man not to cross the line south of my rib cage, lest he wanted to see something we both regretted, our baby boy was born. Except it wasn't a baby boy. It was a 7-pound baby girl. Once the baby was assessed and deemed healthy, Marlboro Man phoned his parents. I drifted in and out of him, in and out of sleep, listening to him talk. But toward the end of conversation, I heard him ask his mom, "So, what do you do with girls?" I chuckled softly. For the first time in our relationship, Marlboro Man was a fish out of water. That September, storms swept through the area, driving Ree and her two-month-old baby into the cellar of a boarded-up house on their property. A pot roast was in the oven, and dark clouds moved in. "I'll be home in an hour," Marlboro Man said, calling from his cell phone. "Have you looked outside?" "Yeah," I said, "it's eerie." The sky was a frightening shade of pink. I hung up, flipped on the TV, and immediately saw a radar map. The weatherman was pointing directly at the area surrounding our county, a swath of dark red in the shape of a hook. Yikes, I thought. Sound asleep in her swing, the baby didn't flinch when the phone rang a second time. "Take the baby and get in the cellar of the big house," Marlboro Man said, with an urgency in his voice. "What?" I said. "There's a tornado moving east to southeast," he said. "You need to get over there just in case." He wasn't kidding, and he loved thunderstorms. I grabbed a huge throw from the sofa, a pillow, three bottles of water, a flashlight, granola bar, and my baby. I ran outside, crossing the yard and scrambling up the steps of the yellow brick house that we had boarded up months earlier. There was no electricity, so I used the flashlight to guide me to the stairs. I walked down into the basement without hesitation, not because I was deathly afraid of the tornado or because Marlboro Man had told me, but because I was a mother now. My protective instincts overrode my fear, allowing me to forget that rattlesnakes had once built a nest in this deep hole. I parked myself on a bench against a wall. A faint hint of the early evening sky was visible through the rectangle window. Slowly rocking my child back and forth as the wind howled above us, I reflected on the months that had brought me to this moment. The transition I'd made from a city girl fleeing a failed relationship to one head over heels in love with a cowboy. From a starry-eyed new wife to clueless and confused new mother. From vibrant sexual being to baby-feeding machine. From a child to a hint of the woman that I would become. It wasn't about me anymore. I had a child and a husband who needed me in the midst of what was turning out to be a terrible time to make a living in agriculture. I no longer had time to get stuck in my own anguish. My new family was all that mattered. This was adapted from her new book, The Pioneer Woman, Black Hills to Tractor Wheels, A Love Story by Ree Drummond. Now it's time for the Answer Lady. This month, our wise and witty expert takes on a hubby whose romantic dinner is hard to stomach, a driver who texts, and a book club dropout. First question. For Valentine's Day, my husband always takes me to some fancy restaurant. Problem is, I hate the food. Is there any way to say something without hurting his feelings? Here's the answer. Let me guess, you don't want to discourage any romantic gestures from your hubby, especially if they're not as frequent as they used to be. I get it, but your special night would be a lot more fun if you could stomach the chow. You need to speak up, but you don't have to come completely clean. Instead, suggesting mixing up your tradition this year. Find a local restaurant with a special Valentine's Day menu. And say for your pitch, Luigi's is great, but I'm dying to try the creme brulee at that new French bistro. Or take over and plan the whole evening. You always do the work. Let me surprise you for once. If he seems sad or confused because you've lost enthusiasm for his beloved routine, make sure he knows that the important things haven't changed. How much you love him. Next question. What's the best way to handle a friend who texts while you're riding in her car? I feel unsafe, but it's awkward to speak up. Answer. It may feel weird, but it's the only sane thing to do. Doesn't she follow the news? People of all ages die every day from this practice, and you could easily Google a story or two from your local paper to show her if need be. But start with a simple, pleasant request. Just say, Marcia, you may think this is silly, but I'm afraid to ride with someone who's not looking at the road. If you want, give me your phone and I'll text for you, or we can pull over. If she doesn't keep her eyes and fingers off her phone after that, you have no choice but to stop riding with her. Suggest that you drive or take your car. Last question. Is there a polite way to quit my book club? It's really gone in a different direction. I can't stand the books we're now reading. Answer. Oh, well, one person's Jodi Picoult is another person's Jane Austen. Just say, this has been fun, but I'm going to retire from book club for a while. I love getting together with you guys, but I'm just not finding time to read anymore. Or if you want to be really straightforward, just confess that you haven't been enjoying the selections. If it turns out the others feel the same way, you can either hang around for a review or of the selection process or stick to your guns and just quit. To soften the blow, consider hosting some other type of event, like a wine tasting or a clothing swap, to help maintain those friendships. Family customs are as quirky and wonderful as families themselves. Here's how one North Carolina clan celebrates together. The family is Michelle and Bill Morton. Children Jacob, 15, Noah, 11, Luke, 7. The family tradition, Valentine's Day fondue dinner. A few years ago, Michelle and Bill Morton realized that going out for Valentine's Day dinner wasn't as much fun as it used to be. It was hard to feel romantic while worrying about the impact of a fancy meal, not to mention hiring a babysitter for their three sons who live on a household budget. So the Raleigh, North Carolina couple, she's a professional organizer, he's a government IT director, decided to make Valentine's Day a family occasion. These days, instead of stepping out on February 14th, Michelle and Bill step into the kitchen and cook up a family favorite, fondue. The boys help with the prep work, and when all the ingredients are assembled, the five of them gather around a communal pot, dipping tortellini, bread, and veggies into a savory cheese sauce while they talk and laugh. In between the main course and dessert, chocolate fondue with fruit, pound cake, and marshmallows, the kids exchange heart-shaped messages. Each boy has to write what he likes best about his brothers. Michelle says, we try to focus on the reason for the holiday, which is love. Perfect harmony. Teaching kids to play the violin is a labor of love for one Idaho musician, the winner of our Maker Difference contest. Perfect harmony. When J.C. Seitz opened her music shop in 2004, students from the nearby elementary school would often come by to check out the instruments and listen to music. A few children asked if they could learn to play, but none of them had money for lessons. I just didn't think it was fair that some kids couldn't learn because they couldn't afford it, says Seitz, who studied the violin in college and now teaches and plays professionally. So she asked the violin instructors at her store in Idaho Falls to offer free group lessons. To spread the word, Seitz and her husband Joe performed at school assemblies. The program, which she called Strings for Kids, quickly outgrew the shop, so Seitz organized lessons at the nearby school. Since Strings for Kids serves children from low-income families, kids must qualify for the free or reduced lunch program to be eligible for lessons. To apply, they submit a teacher recommendation and an essay. Once enrolled, each child receives her own violin, music stand, and books. 12-year-old Janelle Cortez has participated for the past 2 years. I wanted to play the violin, but we didn't have the money, says Janelle. When I learned about Strings for Kids, I said, this is my chance. Janelle's mother, Kay Lynn, couldn't be happier. I think it's awesome, she says. The kids are exposed to classical music and learn about structure and discipline. Seitz has seen many children like Janelle blossom in the program, which has now expanded to 3 more local elementaries. When we put on the recitals, the kids introduce their pieces and play all by themselves in front of an audience. It's very empowering. Kids also make new friends. Some students even go over to one another's houses to practice, she says. Music gives them a common ground. The Idaho Falls community has embraced Strings for Kids, and the group's annual fundraising concert almost always sells out. With that support, Seitz has been able to teach more than 400 students to play. Music helps kids express themselves and boost their self-esteem, she says. We hope that they continue to play and grow, and that the music lives on. Fear of fatness. by Peggy Orenstein. Everyone agrees our daughters should learn to love their bodies, but how can that happen when moms have such mixed up feelings about weight? My daughter Daisy has a classmate, Ava, who's 5 years old and fat. Ava was a fat infant. She was a fat toddler. It's pretty clear that she'll stay a fat little girl, and she'll likely be a fat teenager. Fat, that is to say, having a body mass index above what is considered medically healthy in her natural state. She's a big girl with a big appetite, and that, her mother, Holly, knows could make Ava's life difficult. Holly, who is tall and slim, worries that her daughter will spend her girlhood locked in a losing battle against her size. She wonders daily how she can help her daughter eat healthily, to be more physically active and feel good about her body. She and her husband work with Ava's pediatrician on portion control, on how to distract their perpetually hungry daughter from reaching for seconds or thirds. Sometimes, Holly admits, she feels the urge just to snatch the food out of the child's mouth. The weight would be an issue if Ava was a boy, but with a girl, one who's already enamored of Hannah Montana and Selena Gomez and all things teenagerly, Holly feels if she's a train heading for disaster. It must be so nice not having to worry about this. She sighs as we sit in her kitchen while our girls play calico critters upstairs in Ava's room. I tell Holly she's mistaken. Rare is the mother, whether her daughter is thin or fat or in between, who does not worry about her girl's body image. The standards of female beauty are so punishing that even should a girl miraculously fit them, she still will believe she falls short. As mothers, we may not want our daughters to feel the pressure to conform to that ideal, but what to do with a child who is either physically or temperamentally cannot? Ava happens to be a little ray of sunshine, one of the most delightful, happy children I have ever met. But lately, the occasional cloud has skittered across her bright eyes. She's beginning to recognize that there is something about her that is different from other children. And whatever that something is, it matters. Take the boy on the school playground who taunted her for being fat. Ava marched home, wrote him a note saying, as a five-year-old speaks, that she didn't appreciate the comment and presented it to him the next morning. I was so impressed, Holly thought. Oh, please hold on to that ability for your whole life, because you're going to need it. There have been other incidents, too, and so far Ava has stood her ground. I marvel that these kindergartners already know that being fat is shameful, not a characteristic so much as a character. I mean, of course, they do, right? I've read the studies that nearly half of girls in first through third grade want to be thinner, that 81% of 10-year-old girls are afraid of getting fat, and that half of the 9-year-old girls are already dieting, and that by 7, Canadian girls of normal weight believe they're heavy. I have even heard glimmers of fatophobia from my own daughter. While playing Old Maid, a politically incorrect name, Daisy did not so much as twitch an eyebrow when she picked up the twinkling-eyed spinster with the blue sunbonnet. My girl had a poker face that would rival gamblers, but she groaned when she drew the fat lady. When I asked why, she rolled her eyes and whispered, "Mom, she's fat. Where does that come from? I never comment on my body size in front of her, and certainly don't mention hers. Did she learn it from classmates? Absorb it from movies and books that routinely portray fat people as stupid, greedy, or sinister?" This is where I should offer advice on how to combat the outrageous expectations fostered on our daughters and ensure they grow up with a healthy body image, steering clear of not just eating disorders, but garden variety hatred of their butts. Believe me, after 20 years of writing and talking about girls, I have delivered this script 100 of times. For the record, here's what you are officially supposed to do. Stress what your daughter's body can do over how it's decorated. Praise her accomplishments over her looks. Make sure dad is on board. A father's loving regard and interest in a girl as the first man in her life is crucial. Involve her in team sports. A flotilla of research shows that participation lowers teen pregnancy rates, raises self-esteem, improves grade, and probably cures the common cold. Volunteerism can give girls greater perspective and purpose, reducing body obsession. Media literacy can raise consciousness about marketers' manipulations. I would have rattled off those solutions with confidence and authority before I had my own daughter, because even as I wish it were otherwise, I know in my heart that how girls look make a difference in how the world perceives them. From the get-go, everything in our culture tells girls their looks matter. A lot. Talent, effort, intelligence, they're all wonderful. Yet by middle school, how a girl feels about her appearance, especially if she's thin enough, pretty enough, and hot enough, has become the single most important determinant of her self-esteem. And the more progress girls and women make in other areas, the more that seems to be true. The phase of our own lives have become strangely blurred as girls try to look like adult women, and adult women primp and preen and work to look like girls. A century ago, female self-improvement did not presume a stint under the scalpel, hours at the gym, or a trip to the cosmetic counter. In her invaluable book, The Body Project, historian Joanne Jacobs Brumberg writes that for girls growing up before the First World War, becoming a better person meant being less self-involved, helping others, focusing on schoolwork, reading good books, cultivating empathy. To bring home the point, she compares the New York resolutions of girls at the end of the 19th century to those at the end of the 20th. Here's what a 19th century girl resolved: to think before speaking, to work seriously, to be self-restrained in conversations and actions, not to let my thoughts wander, to be dignified, interest myself in others. Her modern counterpart? I will lose weight, get new lenses, already got new haircut, good makeup, new clothes, and accessories. The 19th century girl may have lived in a more repressive era before women could vote, when girls' sights were set solely on marriage and motherhood, but her sense of self-worth was inevitably internal, a matter of deed over dress. Whatever other constraints she felt, her femininity was not defined by her pursuit of physical perfection. It was about character. How, I wonder, how we, 21st century mothers, with all our economic, political, and personal freedoms, let this happen to our daughters. Certainly, I try my best to raise a girl who has a healthy perspective on her body, regardless of its shape, who does not plunge into a shame spiral whenever she looks at herself sideways in a mirror. I follow all the expert advice mentioned above, but I don't have an intuitive feeling for whether I'm on the right track. Overemphasizing a girl's looks is clearly hazardous, but so is never telling her she's pretty. How to find the sweet spot? I took the quandary to Katherine Steiner Adair, the director of eating disorder education and prevention at the Clamart Eating Disorder Center in Belmont, Massachusetts. You're beautiful is not something you want to say over and over again to your daughter, because it's not something you want her to think is so important. Still, there are times when it's important to tell her that. When she's messy or sweaty, when she's not dressed up, so that she gets a sense that there's something naturally beautiful about her. It's also important, Steiner Adair says, to connect beauty and love, to say, I love you so much. Everything about you is beautiful to me. That way, you're not just objectifying her body. I appreciate that advice. The way it redefined beauty is something both internal and external. Holly, however, was less impressed. What's important to me is to unhook looks from size, she said. Pretty to me is not the point. I think Ava is pretty, and I hope she thinks so too. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of From Soups to Nuts. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Beth Ludwig, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. So long until next time.